Daniel lived a long time ago. What can he tell us about preparing for the end of time? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson from the Walla Walla University School of Theology, your host and study guide. We continue our series on preparation for the end time. My conversation partners are again Matilda Fry and Brant Berglund, both from the School of Theology. Let's go directly to that question. If I were to say, what in the world does Daniel have to say about the end time? He lived thousands of years ago. What would you say?
Daniel mentions the end time in his book by a few different ways. He speaks specifically of the end of the days, the end of the times. In the context of the exile in Babylon, so there is clearly something that the man Daniel and the prophet Daniel look forward to a future when this exile is going to end, and especially from the specific perspective of the Babylonian exile, that must have been a devastating experience for the young Daniel, who meets Nebuchadnezzar the king, the great world empire, in the great world empire.
Revelation will build on this story of the exile, and it'll take the exile story. It'll mention Babylon again, and it'll also mention Daniel's experience and those of his three friends by way of allusion when it talks about a great image that is made and the bowing down to worship an image, and that if you don't worship it, you can lose your life. These very moral issues, it appears that Daniel and his friends go through, are the issues throughout time.
Now, there's one thing that's, and we didn't talk a lot about this, and at least not on the air, about the issues of the heavenly court and how the Old Testament deals with the gods. Ten Commandments says, you shall have no other gods before me, but doesn't exclude the possibility that there would be other gods. And from an Old Testament point of view, God simply appoints those other gods as gods for the other kingdoms. See, so in that setting, we have quite a contrast with some of the lines, for instance, in the prophet Isaiah. He just mocks dead idols. It just says some very sarcastic things. And what I think that we discover is that when you look at Isaiah, he is very much concerned that people will attribute to gods of wood and stone the things that the God of heaven would do. So that's one reason why he comes down very strong. But coming more specifically now to Daniel and the end time, let's compare those two. Daniel is a moral example, and then Daniel is someone who predicts the end time. There are actually four chapters that deal primarily with Daniel as a moral example. Chapter 2, where you have Daniel in the image. Chapter 3, Daniel's friends on the plain of Dura, and Nebuchadnezzar's loss of sanity and return. And then Daniel the lions, who was the faithful prayer in spite of the royal decree. Can those stories give us particular strength for living in the end time?
It seems to me that the issue for Daniel 3, the Daniel and his friends, those who refuse to bow to someone other than the God of heaven, that seems to be important. However, we don't bow perhaps the same way. We certainly don't set up idols and bow down. So we'd be looking for maybe a moral equivalent to the act of physical bowing down. It might be more where our heart and mind are. Jesus says you can't serve two masters. Perhaps money today might be the idol we bow down to. I also found it interesting that chapter 1, Daniel and his friends not eating the king's food, isn't addressed. It could be, and maybe Matilda, you'd have more background on this, but a relationship to food sacrifice to idols might be part of that, perhaps not. But if so, that's certainly an issue all through the book of Revelation as well.
Mm-hmm. I think definitely there are different ways. Chapter 1 is speaking of the moral aspect of Daniel and his friends in the context of the Babylonian world with the Babylonian gods, and also how these young men probably were very much forced to change their religious life, their culture, their beliefs into the Babylonian context. And yes, food is part of it, but there is more, I believe. There is, for example, the way they had to be re-educated into the Babylonian system to learn the sciences and the language of the new place. Even the fact that they were placed under the eunuch, the high eunuch of Babylon, may indicate something that Isaiah also speaks of: your sons will be made eunuchs in Babylon. So what about Daniel and those four young men feeling it on their own body, what it means to be slaves to the new kingdom?
And they're given new names as well to reflect their assimilation into Babylon. And
now, you mentioned something there that they had to be re-educated. I've always considered that to be quite intriguing in terms of conservative forms of Christianity, especially the more conservative aspects of Adventists, who are reluctant to go into higher education. Mm. Here in Babylon, these guys went in head over heels, became thoroughly familiar with it. And I think that that can perhaps be an example for us as we become involved with a larger world.
They passed the test of Nebuchadnezzar with flying colors. They became the best, the top scholars in the kingdom, fulfilling the top positions.
And for several generations as well, right?
Yes.
Now, the other part that I would like for us to look at, and I don't know how you deal with this in your classes, but Daniel has prediction and proof. The official study guide declares that this Daniel chapter 2 provides a revelation of God's foreknowledge and presents evidence for God's existence. Now, I've always been puzzled by that, because if you look at the book of Daniel, there is no way of looking at the book as a whole that gives you a definitive proof where you can nail down. So you have the four kingdoms. Only Babylon is mentioned in chapter 2. None of the four kingdoms in chapter 7 are identified. You have two in chapter 8, but nowhere do you have a grand scheme of things. So I had a teacher when I was at the seminary who talked about apocalyptic, and Daniel is apocalyptic. He says it's unbeatable because it's reheatable. See, wherever you live, you can apply it. See, now that's not quite the same as predicting. And going back to the first lesson when we talked about, it's not as, we don't really need to know when the time is. We simply need to be prepared. How do you deal with the question of conditional prophecy? The fact that this may have been predicted one way, and turns out in another way.
Well, there's certainly evidence. For instance, Jeremiah 18 talks about the conditionality of God. God says that if I say good concerning a nation, but that nation turns from me, then I will relent concerning the good. Daniel isn't given an indication, of course, just like Jonah isn't given an indication that there could be conditionality to it. We look on Daniel 2 rather from a historical point of view and say, oh, it seems like history has lined up with it. Could they have known at the time of Daniel that there would be four successive kingdoms that ruled over Israel in one way or another, and then a divided kingdom? They couldn't necessarily know that. And in fact, looking down through history, when we interpret Daniel from a historical basis, we see that there have been a variety of perspectives, especially of Daniel 7 and Daniel 8. Some have seen far more ties to Antiochus Epiphanes. I know around the first century, that might have even been the view of the disciples of Jesus. So Daniel 2, we have perhaps a benefit of looking at it from history, but it's not what they would have known in Daniel's day.
If we take Ellen White's comment from about 1883, where she says the promises and threatenings of God are alike conditional, See, then, of course, you open up all kinds of possibilities. And she also says in that same context, the angels of God present time as being very short, and so it has always been presented to me. Somehow, if you go too far in advance, you lose the motivating focus of the immediacy, because I think the sense of the immediacy that God could come at any moment is really pretty important.
I think it is important for me to remember that Daniel is cast into the story of the Tower of Babel. When you start the book in verse 1, in the beginning, there is Jerusalem against Babylon, which is in the land of Shinar, with the Tower of Babel, with the concept that people want to make a name for themselves, stay together, reach the heavens, and God mocks them. And the book of Daniel is set into this context, I think. And so when you come to read chapter 2, you have a king who aspires that very idea.
Oh, king, live forever, right?
Yes.
He wants to live forever.
Yes. And now Daniel comes around and says, well, there is a God in heaven. Mm-hmm. And throughout each one of the chapters, 2, 3, 4, the king will progressively come to realize, yes, Daniel's God is much bigger and much higher than all the other gods. In chapter 2, he takes the first step, but it's only in chapter 4 where he praises the God. Mm-hmm. And also one other part in chapter 2 is, I think even if we recognize the imagery with those four kingdoms, it is the stone at the end that fills the world. That is the high point of the vision of the dream here. And that's where Daniel spends most words on, most time, mm-hmm. to talk about it, and not so much about the four kingdoms.
Mm-hmm. In fact, if you look at traditional Reformation Adventist perspective of historicism, you find that quite naturally in the visions of Daniel, where each one ends. It's a roadmap through history, and then you have the stone.
Yeah.
Then in chapter 7, you have the saints receiving the kingdom, and then in chapter 8 and 9, the sanctuary restored. That's quite natural. That pattern, and this is treading on your territory, Brant, but when you get to the book of Revelation, historicism is not obvious at all.
It's much broader in Revelation. It seems to take the story of Daniel and then the stories of the Old Testament and build on them in some very large ways, but it doesn't apply necessarily the same framework right. that we expect. It may use cycles in its explanations, much like Daniel does, but it doesn't use the same cycles and in the same way.
Yeah. Yeah. One last question I'd like to put here, and we only have a few moments left, but if we take away the history books, and I'm thinking of just giving the book of Daniel to someone who doesn't have access to all the history books. Can Daniel still be a blessing even if we have no history books to confirm the historical facts?
Yeah, the stories seem to be inspiring to stand in the face of oppression.
Yeah. And you don't need to nail them down with any particular historical facts.
It's a book to give hope, to give assurance
right.
for the future.
Well, our time is up, and we can look to next week when we are going to the New Testament and look at Jesus in the book of Revelation. My conversation partners will again be Matilda and Brant. My thanks to Jared Miller, our program engineer, to all of you for listening in for The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.